Hello and welcome to the Naked Englishman. Hello and welcome to you, lovely people. It's the 16th of May. It's a Friday, and it's I don't know what the time is. Something. I'll go and have a look. Welcome to the Naked Englishman podcast, as they say in the manner of me, Richard Vobes. It is the 25 minutes to 8 in the morning. And hello to all of you lovely listeners listening with your ears. I had a lovely email from Duncan and his mum. Hello, Anne, his mum. Duncan is his mum's carer and looks after her. Well done. I was doing that with my dear old dad at some point. And the email was to say thank you very much for getting back to him. Duncan and his mum had sent some money. We went to the farm shop and we spent the money on food for Billy. And we took the food round to Billy's house yesterday afternoon when he came back from work. And he was so thrilled, I can tell you. And I'll tell you what we bought. We bought... what did we buy? Well, we got him some raw milk. We got him some sausages, some bacon, some burgers, some braising steak, 2 fillets of chicken, some butter. I did get him some potatoes, carrots, onions. Oh, no, I'm just trying to think what else. Anyway, that sort of thing, which will keep him going, hopefully. But I may not be able to get to the farm shop for another week. But that's okay. So, anyway, thank you very much, Anne Duncan and Anne. It's very, very, very kind of you. People are so generous. And Billy was so thankful. Billy's so touched. He's going to come on the show and talk about his seizure thing, how it happened, what happened, the whole story. Thought it would be quite nice to hear it from him, as much as he remembers, of course. That's the problem. When these things happen to you and you pass out, you don't remember everything because you are not actually awake, if you see what I mean. I'm just making myself another cup of coffee. But it's living with the seizure must be, I mean, I don't know what that's like. At the moment, I'm living with a bruised rib. Billy came round because he's gone back to a sort of remote university, like Open University, I think, or something like that, I can't remember, to do some training on something, or to get a degree or whatever it is that you do at university, and he had to make something, a physical thing, and he needed to borrow some tools, and in my back room it's all full up because I have no loft space, so a number of things are in there in the way. Anyway, so I just use this room as a sort of a storage, and it's got a little bit over full, so in order to grab the tools, I had to clamber over some other things. I didn't fall or anything. I just had to stretch in a slightly awkward way, and somehow or other I bruised a rib. Or it feels that's what's going on in there. I could feel it. You know when you pull your back, or you do something, you go, oh yes, I have just pulled a muscle here. And it's painful. It's that sort of feeling. I'm not really convinced I have damaged the rib or anything. But I think I'm continually poking the muscle with the ribs when I lean in a certain way, and you get that sort of ow type feel, you know. Anyway, and slowly going, but it seems to be taking forever. But, you know, living with that, living with the one eye, and it gunks up, my one eye gunks up rather nastily sometimes, and it's just irritating, it's gritty. It's an artificial eye made from acrylic, and it just gunks up because the body, ever since I've had it, is trying to reject the thing because it's not a natural thing. But living with the seizures, or the potential seizures, I don't know how Billy manages to do that, really, because he can just collapse at any time. I a friend of mine from years ago, I haven't seen him for donkeys, but well, more of an acquaintance, I suppose, than a friend, a chap, juggling chap. His wife had a seizure, brain hemorrhage, dropped down dead, just like that. Just like that, in the kitchen one day, was perfectly fine, got out perfectly fine, see you later, love. He goes off to work, do a juggling gig, comes home, she's collapsed. Brain hemorrhage, no explanation, just, you know, these things do happen. And it's very, very sad, of course. Yeah, I'm going to go out and see. This was, you know, well before COVID, by the way. This was like 30 years ago. It's hard to believe all that time has passed. Come outside, making sure the van is still here, because I had a dream last night, a very strange dream. It was, I was abroad somewhere, but I'd obviously got the van with me, and in the dream I was at a hotel, and go back to the car park where I've left the van, and the van's not there, and I was just like, oh my god, they've taken my van. And I was all, oh, I tell you, and it's one of those frustration dreams where nobody's listening to you, nobody's listening to you, nobody's interested, and I'm going, they've taken my van, they've taken my van, and nobody's like, no sympathy, nothing. And I couldn't find the reception, and I was in this hotel trying to find it, I couldn't find it, and in the end I went into this bar, and I was trying to get somebody's attention to find out where the police station was to report the crime, you know, what else do you do? I said, I haven't even got my hotel room key. I haven't got anything. I've got nothing. Everything was in the van. Nobody was listening in this hotel bar. So I started tapping something, a table or something, with something. And I was getting everybody's, now listen here, you lot, listen. I said, I know it's of no consequence to you, but I've just had my van nicked in the car park. And people were just like nodding their heads, going, no, no, we're not interested. And so I was saying, where's the nearest police station? That's all I'm asking. And people were just not telling me. It was one of those really most frustrating dreams. So I think because I'm heading down to Exeter tomorrow, alone, lovely Julia will be sitting here guarding the house, making sure the cat is fed, and carrying on with the work in the book. She's looking at me going, that's the first I've heard of that.
Well, I was going to say, if I were doing that, well, I would be able to go with you.
Yes, of course. so I shall take the clamp for my car, van.
Chariot.
My chariot. And I shall lock it up when I'm down there, because if it's a premonition that somebody's out to nick a van...
You'd be stupid not to.
I would be stupid not to.
You'd feel very silly if it did get stolen. And you'd
especially as I've just told you lot now. And then can say, oh, I was in this car park at this hotel at the race course, and the van got nicked. So it's not to say it still couldn't be nicked, but it would be a bit more.
It's a little bit harder.
There's a steering lock thingy. I mean, an all-encompassing steering lock, not just a bar, but a whole thing.
Not just
thing.
A bar that can slip and then land on the horn and keep tooting for 25 dang minutes.
Oh, yes.
Oh, my gosh.
Julia had this situation. She was just minding her own business, and then there's this horn going off.
In my own house as well.
Not the horn wasn't in your own house.
No, but it was right next to my house.
She could hear it, and it was just, you know, when it's like... Somebody's,
my tinnitus went crazy, let's say that.
Yeah, you know what it's like when somebody's alarm goes off and you just go, oh, and you look out the window and you go, oh, for goodness sake, will you hurry up and switch that off? Well, this was the horn just permanently on.
5 minutes is bad enough, but this was 25 minutes.
25 minutes. And what had happened is the steering lock had slipped onto the horn mm-hmm. itself and pressed it somehow, but the owner didn't hear it.
No, a neighbour and I, we were walking around the van thinking, what the heck can we do? And eventually, you know, we kind of nudged it and the alarm came on. So, and the guy finally came out.
He came out when the alarm was running.
Even though the alarm was nowhere near as loud as the horn constantly going, ah! Oh my gosh.
Poor old Julie. It's a memory that brings...
I wasn't at all frustrated, can you tell? I was not flustered, no.
No.
Who gets flustered?
Anyway. Who indeed?
Who? Yeah.
who let the dogs out, because they've just...
Let the rage out.
Yeah, they've just mauled Mrs. Jones. Poor old Mrs. Jones!
Hey, poor old Mrs. Jones!
Let's turn the internet on so everybody in the world can utilise it again. They've all... they're all in frozen animation until I click that button. All the virtual characters in the world, all the AI computations. It can't work until I press that little button in my back room that switches on the modem.
How do you drink your tea and coffee so hot?
Well,
it's two-thirds gone, and there's just steam coming out the top.
Mm.
It's still boiling.
It's not that hot. I can't bear hot drinks cold or
if
tepid.
If I drink steaming like that, I can't drink it.
Really?
Yeah, really.
It's not that hot. The milk cools it down.
Yeah.
Once I put the milk in...
Half a degree.
Yeah, that's
it's
enough.
It's a morning 10-minute... what's the word?
Debate? Argument?
Domestic.
Hmm.
Argument.
It's not a domestic. I don't put that much cream in. The raw milk, creamy raw milk, does enough. But it's warm. I love it, coffee warm or tea warm.
Hot. As in Mordor hot.
But I don't know what Mordor means.
The fires of Mordor from...
Harry Potter.
No. It's much more class than that.
Oh, I thought he was a character in...
Who? What?
Harry Potter. Oh, is he in Tolkien? I haven't seen that one either.
Forget Harry Potter. That's nothing.
Yeah, no, it is nothing. Mordor is in Lord of the Rings, is it?
Yes.
I haven't... I've neither read it nor seen the film.
The fires of Mordor is where the rings were forged.
Oh, of course they were, yeah. Not in a nice little back street.
I know, in Hobbiton, wouldn't that be lovely, wouldn't it? Oh dear, the ring's causing a lot of problems. Let's just chuck it back in the forge, it'll be all right.
Is that what happens?
Well, yeah, they've got to, yeah.
And then the whole story is about looking for the bloody things.
Well, no, it's the whole thing is about getting the ring to Mordor and chucking it into the volcanic, fiery... depth of it.
You could imagine a rewrite of Lord of the Rings there, couldn't you, as a modern-day domestic thing.
Where have you put it?
I don't know, darling. I'm looking. Well, go and have a look in this room. I've looked and I've... Go up. You've got to climb up to the roof.
Where were you when you last saw it?
Well, I was just...
If I bloody remembered that, I'd know where it was, wouldn't I?
Yeah, I always think I was adjusting the television area. Well, you've got to climb up a ladder. Because all I know about that is there's a scene. I've seen some snippet scenes... which is why I didn't bother to watch the film, where they're just constantly on the walk up mountains and things. Is that really what the film is about? They're just constantly on the go.
It's a travelling.
Yeah.
They're travelling.
Yeah.
That's what happens. Travelling happens.
Mm.
And lots of other things happen too.
Yeah.
Yeah, you will read it one day.
Will I?
Yeah.
I doubt it.
You will. Even if you're sitting there listening to me reading.
Whereas I... You see, everyone
goes...
You're
going to have that education, okay?
Yes. You see, I think... Oh, have I got it as well? Have I got it?
Don't get me wrong, I'm not a massive...
Everybody quotes that as if it's the thing. I much prefer Melvin Peake's Titus Groan or Gormenghast.
Oh, yeah, that went really, really big, didn't it?
Did it?
No. I've never heard of it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I didn't think you...
You say you've never read Tolkien, but you've heard of it.
I read The Hobbit when I was at school, and it was okay. Yeah. You know, it was interesting. And then I started to read The Lord of the Rings, and Bilbo Baggins was barely in it. There was some other bloody pretender. You know, Freddy or whatever his name is. His nephew. And I thought, come on, we've all just read about Bilbo. He's the hero. And turns out... No,
not the hero.
He wasn't the hero.
I'm pretty sure The Hobbit was written after the rest of
it. Oh, I don't know.
Don't quote me on that.
I'm not going to. But Titus Groan was written by Melvin Peake. When was that written? Probably around about the same time. Just looking to see... So this was first published in 1946. So similar sort of time.
Are they travelling all the time?
No.
Are they on the road?
No, not at all. It's absolutely... it's what inspired some of the writing for Mucklebunt, actually.
Ah, fantastic.
The middle and in the late 1940s saw the appearance of a number of British works of literature which were quick to assume the status of classics, meaning eloquent, authoritative, definitive statements begotten by an epoch but speaking more than the epoch, all who beguiled the bad days of the end of the war and the start of peace by reading four quartets, The Unquiet Grave, Brideshead Revisited, The Loved One, Animal Farm, 1984, were aware these books were only able to say what they did about the human permanence because of the urgency enforced by... I don't know what this is all about. The world... Anyway, it goes on. The world created in Titus Groan is neither better or worse than... I don't know. I thought he might have mentioned Tolkien in there. Culture, rituals, stop dead, refusing to move, self-feeding, self-motivating, self-enclosed. This is the world of Gormenghast. Titus Groan, the first novel in a trilogy... appeared in 1946. Anyway, I just was going to read a little bit. There's a bit with the cook, which is just and all of the different characters. In fact, I think this was inspired me for Blood Hope's Valley, actually, when I first read it.
Blood Hope's Valley?
Yeah, Blood Hope's Valley, and all the characters in there. Oh, here we go. Swelter. The chef at Gormenghast. Gormenghast is this very austere castle set in rocks and all over, you know, with... A myriad of dark foreboding birds swirling round the towers and mists and, you know, all the sort of usual thing. Beautifully described in the opening. The chef at Gormenghast, balancing his body with difficulty upon a cask of wine, was addressing a group of apprentices in their striped and sodden jackets and small white caps. They clasped each other's shoulders for their support, their adolescent faces steaming with the heat of the adjacent ovens, were quite stupefied, and when they laughed or applauded the enormity above them, it was with a crazed and sycophantic fervour. As Mr. Flay approached to within a yard of the cluster, another roar, such as he had heard a moment or two earlier, rolled into the heat above the wine barrel. The young scullions had heard this roar many times before, but had never associated it with anything other than anger. At first, consequently, it had frightened them, but they had soon perceived that there was no irritation in its note today. The chef, as he loomed over them, drunken, arrogant, and pedantic, was enjoying himself. As the apprentices swayed tipsily around the wine cask, their faces catching and losing the light that streamed through the high window, they also, in delirious fashion, were enjoying themselves. The echoes died from the apparent reasonless bellow of the chef, and the sagging circle about the barrel stamped his feet and the sagging circle about the barrel stamped its feet feverishly and gave high shrill cries of delight, for they had seen an inane smile evolving from the blur of the huge head above them. Never before had they enjoyed such latitude in the presence of the chef. They struggled to outdo one another in the taking of liberties unheard of hitherto. They vied for favours, screaming his name at the top of their voices. They tried to catch his eye. They were very tired, very heavy, and sick with the drink and the heat, but they were living fiercely on their fuddled reserves of nervous energy. All saving one high-shouldered boy, who throughout the scene had preserved a moody silence. He loathed the figure above him, and he despised his fellow apprentices. He leaned against the shadowy side of the pillar out of the chef's line of vision. Mr. Flay was annoyed, even on such a day, by the scene. Mr. Flay is a different character who's come into it. Although approving in theory, in practice it seemed to him that the spectacle was unpleasant. He remembered when he had first come across Swelter. Swelter is the chef. and how he and the chef had instantaneously entertained a mutual dislike, and how this antipathy festered. To Swelter, it was irksome to see the bony, straggly figure of Lord Septualgrave's first servant in his kitchen at all, the only palliative to this annoyance being the opportunity which it afforded for the display of his superior wit at Mr. Flay's expense. Mr. Flay entered Swelter's steaming province for one purpose only, to prove to himself as much as to others that he, as Lord Groan's personal assistant, would on no account be intimidated by any member of the staff. To keep this fact well in front of his own mind, he made a tour of the servants' quarters every so often, never entering the kitchen, however, without a queasiness of stomach, never parting it without a renewal of the spleen. The long beams of sunlight, which were reflected from the moist walls in a shimmering haze, had pranked the chef's body with blotches of ghost light. The effect from below was that the dappled volume of warm, vague whiteness around the grey that had dissolved into swamps of midnight, a volume that towered and dissolved among the rafters. As occasion merited, he supported himself against a stone pillar at his side and as he did so the patches of light shifted across the degraded whiteness of the stretched uniform he wore. When Mr. Flay first eyed him, the cook's head had been entirely in shadow. Upon it the tall cap of office rose coldly, a vague topsail half lost in the fitful sky. The total effect there was indeed something of a galleon. He goes on, he's just so lurid in his descriptions. That's what I really like about him. And the story sort of, I can't remember exactly, it's about this, I think it's a sort of a love affair of somebody inside this character. I forget his name now, Peake or whatever his name was. Oh no, it's Mervyn Peake is the author. There's Lord Groan, Lady Groan, Nanny Slag. The names are just lovely. And what I like about the names... Pardon?
It's not what I'd have described as lovely.
Well...
Funny, quirky.
Quirky and easy to say. Mm. There are names in books that you cannot get your tongue round, which I find... You know, I think Terry Pratchett has names that you can't get your...
I don't know, I don't think I've ever had a problem getting my tongue round.
Oh, right, fair enough.
Yeah, I mean, things like Nanny Og.
Oh, okay, fair enough. I'm just trying to think of some book. I've read books, English authors, and they sort of have names that go, Heigenhofschuber was clearing out the back room.
We've read one together.
Oh, yeah, what was that?
I can't remember, though.
And these...
Georgiana, was it?
No, it wasn't Georgiana. But some books where they just invent the names... You see, in my Blood Oaks Valley book, which was... I have yet to write, but I have written part of it years ago. I started this thing, and it was all these characters. You've got a McNasty, so you've got Emperor Bloodhope, who is the Emperor, and he's a big fat, you know, he's a sort of bumbling idiot who's inherited his sort of right to be the Emperor, as it were. He's got his henchman, he's got his second-in-command, V-Dive, who is, you know, he's a sort of sinister character, and he's got a henchman, Seedlinger. There's the official archivist in the caves, Podweeple. And there's all these different ones with beautiful names. And I think I must have been inspired by this, because, you know, Swelter is a great name for the cook, the chef, in this very hot, with cauldrons burning and bubbling liquid and moist stuff on the walls dripping down, all of that sort of thing.
That's a question. How did you come to the name Splidge for the Cragg?
Splidge? I don't know how Splidge came.
Is it because he was supposed to be a bit of a drip?
No. Splidge came about one day. I was sitting at Dance Industry, which was a dance school, And I'd rented an office there in Littlehampton, and I was using the dance school. I'd just come out of mime school, and so it was about 1986. And I was using the dance school to carry on doing the exercises I wanted to do and put together a theatre company, a mime thing. And I was working on something called Tiny Aeroplanes, which was a story about a guy who flies model aircraft and reenacts the Battle of Britain with these. And I had to depict this as a one-man solo show, mm-hmm. Tiny Aeroplanes, and we did. And I was like, you know, doing the Battle of Britain as a one-man show of a bloke, because it was all in his head. So it was very, I don't know what you would call it now. It was very fringy. Anyway, it was very good, and people loved it. But we were sitting one day in the little coffee bar that they had there, and there were people who hung around, sort of, you know, young theatricals, who hung around. I was in my 20s. They were in their sort of teens, early 20s. We hung around. One day, they were all gaggled around, having a cup of coffee, eating, drinking cans of fizzy drinks and whatever. I've always been interested in writing, and I was sitting down. I opened a pen. I opened a pad, and I had a pen. And just because they were over there, I was sitting down thinking of ideas for plays and things and what have you. And I just wrote from nowhere the title Splidge the Cragflinger. And I had no notion what Splidge the Cragflinger was. I had no idea it was going to be a book. I had no notion that I was going to write a trilogy. And then I wrote, it was always raining in the land of Gud. It never stopped. It must have stopped occasionally, otherwise the city would have been washed away by floods long ago. One day, King Gudamak was peering through an oblong-shaped window in the palace. Oh dear, he thought, raining again. And with that, he climbed into his bright red Macintosh. And that's as far as I got about that. I remember that very distinctly. Yeah. And Stanley was quite young. Well, no, Stanley wasn't even born. And I remembered at some point, I remembered some later years later reading. Oh, that's right. I was doing. Sorry about this. It's probably going on a bit long, isn't it? I was doing Percy Peevely for the Services Sound and Vision Corporation, which was part of the BFBS, the British Forces stuff. I was doing that stuff where you know, in the days of. Before satellite TV, this was, or satellite TV was just coming on stream, but they used to take programmes off air, off the BBC, would record them, repackage them with their own presenters, and send them to Germany and Cyprus to the troops and their families stationed over there and play them out. And they had this, they wanted to do a cartoon show. This was in the 80s. They wanted to do a cartoon show, and I had managed to get an interview with this chap, Richard somebody or other, nice bloke, and I'd sold him the idea of my masked character, Percy Peevely, and we put together Percy Peevely's World of Cartoons, which I still have on VHS. Oh, blige. And that's where Mr. Todd came from. Julia's watching her phone, completely ignoring everything I say. It's all right, you carry on. You've heard all this before. No. And I can't remember what the question was. How did Splidge come about? Oh, yeah. So I thought this was quite successful, this World of Cartoons. All I had to do was I did four links, basically. But in each episode, Percy Peevely, this masked character... that I was going, oh, hello there. Welcome to another exciting episode of Percy Peevely's World of Cartoons. Oh, blige, I'll tell you, I'm doing some very exciting things today. I've set up a library, and you're going to love it. I've got to have this shelf here. It's a lovely shelf, and the only thing is, don't tell anybody. I've only got one book. Oh, blige. And then, you know, the phone would ring, and oh, excuse me a minute. And you'd have this candelabra phone. Hello? Is that... Oh, hello, Mr. Todd. That's Mr. Todd, my boss. Yes, Mr. Todd. Yes.
That's right. I am setting up the library. And if I've got one, but... Oh, he says, I've got to go and get some more books. Oh, dear. Listen, whilst I go and get some more books, why don't you watch Super Ted? I'll see you in a minute. And then you'd watch a cartoon, and it'd come back, and then he was like, he's got three books. Oh, I've just been down to the old junk shop. I've managed to... Look, this is this book, and this is... And I wrote all the scripts. I put the set together. I did everything on that show. And they had remote cameras in the studio. So I was filming to remote cameras. So it's like from the 80s I was doing what similar as I do upstairs, really. But I'd built the set. It was very naff in their studio. I'd sold them the idea, and they had the cartoons, and I just wrote the scripts and provided all the props, everything. And I was like in my 20s. It was, you know. And I thought, I could follow this up with a Jack and Ori type thing. I'd write stories for children. And that's where I thought, when I've written the first bit about Splidge, I thought, yes. And so I wrote, and I have somewhere, the original Splidge scripts of Splidge and the Crag. And, of course, then one day I remember I showed them to Stanley and said, you should write a book. And that's when I thought, yeah, I could do, write them into a book. And originally it was going to be a series of short stories. And I've got, my mate Jimmy did some pictures of it all. It's in a folder somewhere. Splidge the Crag Flinger. But it never, again, like all the things in my life, suddenly never quite, you know, it was like the big thumb came down and said, you're not supposed to succeed at this.
This is not the path for you.
I didn't realise that. I just thought every door was shutting in my face. So they didn't want it, and then, you know, trying to get it published or whatever. And then years later, 20 years later, I started to write it as the book it is now is, and have self-published it. And it's a much better story than it, of course, because before it was more, not baby story, but real toddler stuff. But the essence of the story, whereas now it holds up, adults can read that and enjoy it, as indeed some of them do occasionally. Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, I've waffled on terribly much today. I must go. I've got to make videos and things. Toodlepip.
Hang on. When I get a little, just in response to yesterday, ladies don't wallow in the bath. Pigs wallow, or hippos. Hippo can wallow. Men soak in the bath, and ladies infuse in the bath.
Ah, there you go.
There we go.
Just to clarify that from yesterday.
Yesterday.
Until the next time we speak, toodle pippin.